Blog Talk Radio.
Hey guys, welcome to the show, Movie Geeks United. Another jam-packed two-hour show tonight.
No, man, it's like really jam-packed. I mean, and this is all because of Hugh Hefner, a fine American.
The director of a new documentary on Hugh Hefner, which is one of the best documentaries of the year. It's this one and the Joan Rivers documentary are really great works that I've seen this year so far. They're both equally great. But I posted that the director of the Hugh Hefner documentary is coming on. Everybody assumed it was Hugh Hefner himself.
No, man, he's got his PJs on. I mean,
yeah. Maybe he's listening. Maybe he'll be inspired to call in.
Hi, Hugh.
Yeah, hey Hugh. Hey, Chris, how you doing, man?
Hey, what's going on? Doing great.
Hey, Chris.
How about you? What's going on, Jerry?
Not much, man. How you doing?
You know, I'm pretty good. I have no complaints, none whatsoever.
That's good. That's always good.
Yeah, usually.
We're all converged here in the top of the show to discuss the big movie from this past weekend that has been and is being discussed ad nauseum everywhere you turn, and that's Inception, of course. I know that we've all seen it, obviously, so we can freely discuss it. And, you know, everybody's concerned about, especially with this movie, the idea of spoilers when you discuss it. And I'm sensitive to that. But if in our analysis of it, if a certain spoiler of a plot point is unavoidable, let me just give you guys the warning that that might occur during this next half hour. But honestly, spoilers don't spoil Inception. I mean, do you guys think it's kind of spoiler proof, right?
I think it is. Yeah. Not only is it spoiler proof, but really, I can't think of any. There's no one thing really that you could say to someone. Nothing jumps to mind anyway. I mean, it's not like Sixth Sense where there's some huge reveal or something like that. There are things, just like in any movie, that you don't know what's going to happen, but that's just good script writing. It's not really surprises.
I also have to say in regard to that, while I have deliberately not listened, I didn't listen to the Slash film podcast. I read the reviews of those writers, but I haven't listened or read anything since seeing the movie.
Okay.
Deliberately.
I barely read anything leading up to it. I just kind of skimmed to get a take on whether they liked it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And I still do that now, but I did listen to the Slash Film podcast, and for those out there that haven't heard it, I liked it. I mean, it's basically an hour and a half conversation about Inception,
mm-hmm.
half of which is taken up by an interview with Armand White. And actually, he makes so much more sense to me hearing him speak than reading his reviews.
That's a good point with
his ideas are so much more solidified and more precise when I hear him speak. I don't necessarily agree with him, but I don't have to agree with his points, you know.
No. I read the review, but what in the interview that he gives, and I do like Slash Filmcast, I just deliberately didn't want to listen to anything because I'm still thinking about the movie and I would like to see it one more time. In the theater, you know, before I really listen to anyone else's viewpoints on it, outside of the show, of course. But what did he say? I mean, what was he really doesn't like Nolan, does he?
That's essentially what it comes down to. And so, and that was a question posed to him. He said, "Look, I go to a movie, and believe it or not, I want Nolan to impress me, but I'm consistently disappointed with Nolan." Whereas our take on his view of any Nolan film would possibly be, you know, he's just waiting to hate it, or
right.
he already knows he hates it before he sees it, which may or may not be true. Maybe he's being
mm-hmm.
disingenuous when he says
right.
that's not the case. So he just doesn't like Nolan his perception of things to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't gel with him. So everything tumbles from there. I mean, his criticism of Inception is no different from his criticism of The Dark Knight. But what about our criticism of Inception?
I was going to say, what the hell are we spending so much time talking about fucking Harmony Light?
Yeah, really. We gave this guy a platform for crying out loud. I mean,
and the other thing is, if you've read his review, it opens up with some line about how Chris Nolan doesn't have a natural filmmaker's eye. You don't need to read anything or hear anything else. Like, he doesn't like him. He didn't want to like the movie.
Yeah.
I don't believe that line that he said about how he wants him to impress. I do not believe that about him anymore. The guy's completely disingenuous. I can't even believe we even discuss him anymore.
Yeah, I know. I have to agree with Chris. I was ready to
end it. I mean, Jerry just asked a question and I answered it. So.
Yeah, no, I just wanted to. I'm curious to see if there's anything new in that and in his tired analysis, and there isn't. So.
I just want to make mention. I got an email earlier today from a listener, and they were saying, "I'm dying to hear what you guys think of Inception. When are you guys going to talk about it?" And I accidentally deleted the email. I'm so sorry, whoever out there wrote the email that's listening. I didn't want to avoid you. It was a mistake. But tonight, right now, you're about to hear it. That's the answer. Okay, we all saw it, Chris. You were the least enthusiastic of the three of us on The Dark Knight. Last time around with Nolan, even though you did think it was a terrific movie. How do you fall with Inception?
Yeah, at least enthusiastic. I mean, I probably would have given the movie an A-minus or something like that. I love that movie. I want to be clear about that. And I love this movie. I thought it was different, although it explored some of the interesting themes that he has always explored. I thought it was really, really unique and special. I thought it was a fun experience. I thought it was exhilarating. I thought it was profoundly confusing in a good way. I mean, it was challenging to watch.
Yeah.
It's a movie that like you said, Jamie, and you put it perfectly, you can't watch it passively. It's never going to be the kind of movie that you're going to sort of put on in the background while you clean the house or something like that.
That's right.
It's not like that. I thought the movie, I loved everything. I mean, the movie's flawed, just like The Dark Knight is flawed, but it can't be ignored just the same. Like, it just, everything from the performances to the screenplay to the execution to the score, that incredible score. The movie has, like, an operatic feel, in my opinion. It feels very operatic, and it even moves in these sort of movements. Everything about it was really enjoyable.
Let me ask you this.
And I had to go see it twice because I had to see it the next day, which is something, I don't know if I've done that since I was 13 years old and Jurassic Park came out. It was probably the last time I saw a movie and went back to the theater the next day to see it. And as a child, it was just because I was nuts about dinosaurs, but this time it was because I was so fascinated by this movie and so confused by it that I just had to see it a second time.
Well, let me ask you this. This might, because this is a little confounding to me. And Jerry, you can chime in on this too.
Okay.
What is it about? And I'm not talking about the plot. What is it exploring?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I was thinking about that afterwards. The thing is, the movie doesn't really have that much to say. Like, it's not a movie that really explores anything. Like, I mean, it's kind of generally brushes, you know, like, has a nodding, you know, interest in dreams and maybe, you know, our own demons and that sort of thing and regret and these sort of general notions. But it doesn't really have anything to say, and I think he could have made the same argument about The Dark Knight and Batman Begins, certainly. He sort of makes movies about characters that are obsessive and characters that are sort of living with decisions that they've made. And as far as I can tell, he's not interested in making movies about anything other than that. He does it very, very well. It's sort of like Woody Allen or something like that. don't know what the movie's exploring. Other than those same themes that he's always hammering on, I don't see that the movie explores anything else. And that's fine. He can continue to make those kind of movies.
Yeah.
If he's going to make them at this level, fine.
Yeah. I think this brings up a good point. I do think it is, if you wanted to look at it from one viewpoint, and I only say this from, so I've only seen it once, and I will say once with eyes glued on the screen, trying to, like, you know, make sure I got everything from everything I heard leading up to seeing it. I think, in one sense, if you want to look at it from one viewpoint, from Leonardo DiCaprio, the Cobb character, it's about guilt, in one sense. If I wanted to go that route, I'm not sure I want to go there all the way yet, but just looking at his story and his explanations and Ellen Page's reactions to his actions in all those in the second half of the movie, there's a lot of guilt, and it's something that Leonardo DiCaprio does very well. I mean, a double feature of this and Shutter Island, that's quite a thing. But he's so good at playing
and Nolan's Insomnia, which is solely about guilt.
Yeah, I mean, he's really. The Cobb is really upset, and he brings up, and Chris brings up a great, he deals with these obsessive characters. I mean, Bruce Wayne is one of the most obsessive characters in contemporary pop culture. And
also Lenny from Memento.
Lenny's in a class by himself.
Yeah, as far as obsessive goes.
Yeah, I mean.
There's also the reality of who someone is and who they project themselves to be, their fantasy version of themselves, or who they want to be, what they set out to be, and how that is different from who they are in reality.
Yeah.
And I see a little bit of that here,
mm-hmm.
but I don't feel a sense of direction or purpose like I did in The Dark Knight or Insomnia. The Dark Knight, I thought was about something. I thought it was clearly a movie of its time in that it infused in a comic book genre a story about how you combat an evil that only exists to wreak chaos,
mm-hmm.
that gets off on your trying to defeat it, you know, and how do you do that and not compromise yourself in the process?
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that several characters in The Dark Knight represented different facets of that challenge, and
mm-hmm.
it's a challenge that echoes through the U.S. and what we're dealing with the war and stuff, or any number of situations. So I thought the Dark Knight had something to say and it had some relevance. It could also be enjoyed as a comic book movie. Now, I enjoyed Inception as a puzzle movie. I didn't find much more beyond that to enjoy it for.
Yeah, that's interesting. You know, I mean, for me, I never really got the... I can see where someone would get those sort of themes from The Dark Knight. That's not really anything that I ever got from it.
Mm-hmm.
Although when you say it like that, it certainly makes sense.
Yeah. It's a great analysis of that film, by the way. That's the best analysis I've heard of Dark Knight.
Yeah, that's truly very interesting. Back to Inception, a puzzle movie is probably the best way to put it. And let me tell you something, it doesn't lose anything the second time you watch it. In fact, I would argue that it is far more intense the second time. It's a movie that is made to be seen a second time, and I'm guessing probably a third and a fourth time.
I think
there are lots and lots of layers, if you'll pardon the expression that is used heavily in that movie. There's layers to this movie that cannot be picked up on the first time. It's just wouldn't know, you know. You just
right.
Wouldn't know.
Let me ask you this: did you notice yourself the second time you watched it? Because I almost went back Friday morning to see it again, but I just didn't have time. Or I would have definitely gone back to see it. But did you? Is there anything like right off the bat that you picked up a second time?
You mean major themes or small
major
moments?
Major, anything that you might have missed the first, like you know, like
oh. Absolutely. No,
okay.
There's tons of stuff. Look, Jamie and I were talking about this earlier. You walk out of this movie, and it's interesting what's happening with this movie as far as the public's perception of it, because there seems to be a certain like amount of intellectual pride that has been jarred up by this movie, and people are sort of unwilling to, because a lot of people are saying that this movie is incredibly confusing, and I agree, and I do think it is intentionally confusing. And I don't think it's, like, ridiculous. I don't think it's, like, Mulholland Drive or something like that. Or a better example would be, you know, the last David Lynch movie, intentionally confusing with no, with nothing to tie anything to. It's just random. I don't think that's the case with Inception. It's meant to be confusing, and people are sort of unwilling to accept that there are elements of this movie. I don't care how smart you are, how wise you are, you cannot get it all on the first time.
No, I don't
it's
see
not
how.
Possible.
I just don't
no.
see how. Remember what Kubrick said? Someone asked him what he thought the ending of 2001 was. He goes, "I have no idea."
Yeah.
But you know what? I do think that Chris Nolan knows every nook and cranny of Inception. He lived with it for 10 years. I don't think I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt that there are no holes in it, that he can explain every turn.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and some filmmakers that make films of this sort, I don't think they necessarily can. You know.
Right.
But it's not that I don't like it. I really like the film.
Mm-hmm.
It is a great cinematic experience.
Right.
But I think it's already suffering from overpraise. I don't think it's a – how do you classify a masterpiece? First of all, I don't know that you can classify a masterpiece in its first week of release, any movie.
No, you can't.
Secondly, doesn't a masterpiece have to have something to say? Can it
– No. No,
it doesn't?
Not necessarily, Jamie. That...
No, absolutely not. No, I mean, does King Kong have something to say?
Yeah.
Which one?
I can't tell you what it is. But it's King Kong.
No,
just off the top of well, both of them have the same themes.
Yeah.
Both of them deal with who the real beast is.
I think if you want to know what King Kong, the themes of King Kong, all you have to hear is Dieter Hellstrom's explanation of the game in Inglourious Basterds.
Okay, well, maybe that's a bad example then.
Yeah.
But you see my point. I mean, you can look at Inception and you can find themes. We already did.
King Kong forwarded the animal rights movement 50 years.
I'm not going to repeat what Peter says in the film, but yeah, okay.
That's fine. Go ahead, Chris. I'm sorry I interrupted.
No, it's okay. You know, I mean, we've already talked about some of the themes that are explored in this movie, and, you know, themes about guilt and obsession and
mm-hmm.
how a man, you know, has to live with two lives, how he can, you know, justify living his private life and his professional life and all these kind of things.
Right.
And I do think it's the kind of movie that you need to see more than once for all that sort of stuff to sink in. There's lots of movies that are just like that. You can see it, and you can see it once or twice, and it doesn't all sink in. And I don't think the themes of King Kong or Wizard of Oz or any of the great, you know, simple masterpieces of all time are meant to be, you know, I don't think it's like Dieter or whatever his name is and Inglourious Basterds says. I don't think they set out to make a movie that parallels the African-American experience.
No. I mean, that was part of the humor, the beauty of that scene is when he says that and you burst out laughing because you know what's written on the card.
Judge
Roy
Bean.
Not only that, but it's true. It's true. I mean, those parallels are there with King Kong. What I'm saying is I don't think they set out to make
movie
that was...
Oh, no. I agree with you there, Chris. I think it is too soon. I see where Jamie's going with this. This movie's been out for less than a week, and people are calling it a masterpiece. And most of these people who are saying this have only seen it once, unless they've seen it. They might have seen it twice. But regardless of that, you have to remember there's something else going into play when they're saying this. Everyone's saying it's the best movie of the summer or whatever, and this comes with a footnote where it hasn't been a great summer or whatever, a great year for movies.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you start using, I don't care what the movie is, whether it's Inglourious Basterds, Inception, or whatever the movie is, when you start using the rubric or whatever, and saying it's a masterpiece when the playing field there isn't a lot out there. And that's not good either. I think the true test, I think what we would all three of us would agree here, is years from now, we watch this movie like in 5 years and think it's a masterpiece. And that's going to be true with a lot of films we talk about on this show. I think with some of them like Zodiac, I think that will age very well. And I think Inception will age very well. But I just think within a week of its release, it's a masterpiece? Come on.
Yeah, I do like it very much. There are faults in it, but the faults don't really matter. I mean, the staging of the whole snow ski section was a little convoluted for me, unclear for me. Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio has the only role in the whole thing that's actually written, which is not unusual for a heist movie, because most of the sidekicks are just playing types.
You know. Archetypes, yeah. But
yeah.
I will say this, though, and I have to say this about the cast. I do think the casting is spot on. I think all the performances for a film of this caliber are top-notch. I mean,
you say that, and I've heard that being said, but what do they have to play?
Well, they are playing – let me put it to you like this. I think the big word – I know a lot of people say this, but the big surprise is Ellen Page. I actually think she's really good in this. She's not playing the quirky girl or whatever. She's actually playing, you know, I think a real substantial role here. I actually think she's very good. And I know I'm the only person on the face of the earth who praised her in Whip It, but I think she's incredible in this. I think Levitt is just out of this world in this film.
I was telling Chris, I'm just tired of Joseph Gordon-Levitt dressing like a gay bartender in every movie he does. Can't get
okay, all right. I'm not going to touch that with a temper.
Who dresses him?
It wasn't his mom, I can assure you that. And it wasn't the set designer from Third Rock from the Sun either.
I got to see him in that movie, Heschers, just so I could see him wear something that doesn't make him look like he just walked off the pages of Akira.
Okay, yeah? Well, watch a movie, Uncertainty, that came out last year. He doesn't look like he walked off the set of Akira on that either, or Manic for that matter. But I actually thought like all the performances were top-notch. I really didn't have a... I mean, I really thought everyone brought their A game as far as the acting went. I really didn't have a complaint at all.
Well, they're all good actors. But my point is they're not given anything to play. DiCaprio is the only defined character with an arc, which is fine. And it's kind of commonplace for these kinds of movies, like I said. The other thing that interests me is that he did not choose... I mean, you could get more of a dreamlike quality from 10 minutes of any Lynch film and the opening 10 minutes of 8 and a half than you do throughout the entire film of Inception. And it's interesting because that's intentional. Nolan did not want to recreate a dreamlike state.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted it to be realistic because his point was, and it's vocalized in the film, when you're dreaming, you feel like it's real. It's only upon reflection that you realize
right.
That.
Well, that's a very good point. No, I agree with you about the Lynch. And it is interesting, the Lynch films, especially the ones from the last decade, they all have that dream, intense dream quality to them. And 8 and a half, the whole film, I think, is a dream. But
yeah, it's almost like he didn't want to do that because it's been done before.
Yeah.
So instead of doing something that's been done before, he went and made a movie where people shoot guns for 2 hours, you know?
Yeah. Now, I mean, there's a lot of ingenuity in the film. I mean, the whole and the time element with the whole the truck going over the bridge and it taking forever to fall because the dream time is at a slower pace than real time. And I thought that there was a lot of ingenuity there and a lot of ideas. It's a movie of ideas and concepts more than emotionality. And for me personally, I can admire movies about ideas and concepts, but it has to strike me at an emotional level for me to truly get with it. I mean, truly be over the moon about it.
Well, no, I got that from your status update a couple of days ago. You've said this is kind of like a common reaction to a lot of Nolan's films that you have, that the emotion level isn't there. And I can see that from a point. You're not the first person to say that, actually.
But I did feel it with The Dark Knight, and I really felt it with Insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, regardless of Pacino's participation, I thought Insomnia is probably the movie that has the most heart out of anything that Nolan's done. I mean, I don't remember Prestige very much, but I don't recall feeling it as much in that.
See, I feel it here, but only when everything is when the whole movie's taken in, when you've witnessed the whole film. I do feel, if the ending is what I think, I'm not going to talk about what the ending is, but if the ending is what I think it is, at least, from what everything that leads up to that, I do think there's a lot of emotion there, but that's only from my perception so far in one viewing. I may go back and watch it again next week and be like, ooh, maybe I was wrong.
Go ahead, Chris.
I hate to hammer home this second viewing thing, but It's incredibly, it's much more emotional the second time you see it. In fact,
okay.
I was literally near tears the second time I saw it towards the end of the movie, particularly emotional moment. I mean, the movie has a lot, it's a lot about regret. And if there's one word, one concept, one idea that sums the movie up, I do think that's probably it. Either regret or guns.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I also don't think it's fair to say that there's no other characters in the movie that are well-rounded. The Cillian Murphy character has a little bit more to do than some of these other people.
Right.
And I think his performance, actually, as a supporting role, is probably the best supporting performance in the movie. Although I love everyone else, too.
Yeah.
Ken Watanabe. Mm-hmm. And Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Tom Hardy, who's going to be a huge fucking star.
He was great. Wasn't he just incredible in that? I mean, really good.
It's a great introduction for him to American audiences.
Yeah.
He's going to be big, I guarantee you.
Well, I was going to say something else, and I forgot what it was. I was joking with Chris earlier that the only thing I really didn't understand about the movie was any line that Ken Watanabe said. That was a joke.
Yeah.
But
it's
never good when you have to qualify.
I think we can all agree that this is a fascinating cinematic experience.
Yeah. It's unique.
We don't see that often lately.
And you brought up a good point, too, about rating the quality of Inception against the poor quality of all the other movies that have come so far this year. That makes us put Inception at a higher esteem, possibly. I mean, I express that often with horror movies. When I finally see a decent one,
I
rave about it because they're so rare. And here's something that we've been begging for, an original non-remake, non-sequel movie. And that's definitely what this is.
Mm-hmm.
So bless Warner Brothers for investing in it.
I have to say, we talked last week or the week before that, you know, Chris Nolan wants to do a James Bond movie. After watching this, watching especially the snow scenes, which are very influenced on Her Majesty's Secret Service, I'm going to be very honest and very blunt here. I think if he were to do a James Bond movie, it would be a major step down for him after this film.
It would be stepped down for him, but it would majorly revive that.
Oh, it would majorly revive the thing. But I actually don't even know if Batman 3 after this is going to be. I mean, I definitely want to see it, and I have high hopes for it. But this is quite an achievement for a filmmaker. I mean, this guy really. I just don't know how you. This is like when I was talking about Paul Thomas Anderson. Well, There Will Be Blood. They really take their game up to the next level and sort of leave everyone else in the dust. And I think he's done that here. Nolan has definitely done that here.
He loves working on big canvases, too.
Yeah.
So I don't know necessarily that it'll be we'll probably have to wait a long time before he makes anything intimate again.
Yeah, that's...
Or small.
I don't know when that's going to be.
Because I think he has large tastes, and he's admitted to such, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I almost,
well, you know, Insomnia, The Prestige, and Memento are arguably fairly small.
Yeah, they are.
The Prestige, yeah, it's definitely.
But I think he's at a place now. I think he's at a post-Titanic Cameron phase now. And I don't know that we're going to get back to, those kinds of sized movies like Insomnia and Memento, certainly.
I don't know about that, Jamie. I think that he's not the kind like James Cameron, who's going to always want bigger and better, and James Cameron can deliver on bigger and better. But I do feel like Chris Nolan is the kind of guy who would get bored with this kind of stuff. He doesn't like 3D. He also seems like he would even get bored with, like, the Batman stuff. Like, I have a feeling, like, he's not going to want to do that. You know, he might, and I hope he does, because he makes fucking good Batman movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I feel like, I don't know. With this movie, he's almost more, like, cast himself into a Hitchcock role, in
mm-hmm.
my mind. He's capable mm-hmm. of going and making something like The Birds, you know,
mm-hmm.
Which is just, you know, it's just pure cinematic delight.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing to it. Like, I can do this, and then I can go. I can jump back and do something a little bit smaller, you know, immediately afterwards. Or I can paint on a big canvas. In my mind, Chris Nolan is the one filmmaker of our time who has more in common with Hitchcock than anyone else. Mm-hmm. I do think he's capable of that kind of tension.
Let me ask you guys a question, though. This is a question that's come up, and that's I hate using this term, but, you know, we talked about this with Avatar. It was a game changer of a film. And, you know, in one sense, as far as 3D goes, it has been, but everyone's been learning the wrong lesson. But do you think Inception is a game changer in any way?
It has yet to be seen.
Okay.
I am fascinated. I'm going to be fascinated by how it performs in its second weekend. A movie that requires this much active participation and thought as you're watching it, I'm curious how many people are going to go back to see it, or if it was just too exhausting for them the first time. I'm talking about, you know, middle Mary. I'm talking about Joe Schmo, not the movie fanatics.
Right, right.
The ones that drive the box office.
Right. No, the reason that's a good point. That's a very good point, because this is definitely something that, of course, we want to, you know, Chris has seen it twice. We want to go back and see it again. You bring up a great point. How is it going to perform? Will people want to go back? And there's a lot of factors that go into that. You know, we don't live in a time right now where that disposable income is as handy as it was when The Dark Knight came out.
And yet this is Leonardo DiCaprio's biggest opening.
It is, without a doubt.
I don't see it as a game changer. And actually, in terms of influence, I do see the Kubrick influence a lot in Nolan. And I was surprised hearing an interview with him today that a major influence on him is Alan Parker, that he would watch The Wall and study The Wall prior to making Inception.
I see that. I see the influence of The Wall, but that is a very surprising admission that you would, Alan Parker of all people, but I can see the influence of The Wall. Talk about a film that many people have seen many times, and it's also, and a movie that is actually encouraged for you to watch under the influence.
But what I really feel, look, I recognize Kubrick as having been a masterful filmmaker. From a craft standpoint. And I recognize the same quality in Nolan.
Mm-hmm.
What I also recognize in them both, and I know this is blasphemy because you both love Kubrick, so many people love Kubrick, but you've already heard how I respond to movies on an emotional level.
Mm-hmm.
I see them both as people that are obsessed with exploring ideas and certain themes, but not necessarily feeling them. It's like a mathematician approaching it like from some kind of scientific fascination, rather than one that is deeply felt.
Mm-hmm. No, there's.
Do you think
some truth?
Do you think
that
has anything to do with the fact that they're both Americans who chose to live in England?
I don't know. It could. It very well could.
Isn't that bizarre? Never occurred to me before, but I highly doubt it has anything to do with that. But it is a funny coincidence.
Yeah, I didn't know that. It is very funny, Chris. But that's not blasphemy, what you're saying about Kubrick or even Nolan. I know in some circles it would be, but it's really not blasphemy.
It's not necessarily a. A bad criticism of Kubrick, because if that's the kind of filmmaking you respond to, then that's what you get with Kubrick. I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm not saying that certain people can't reach those kinds of films.
Right.
I've just never been able to feel them.
But did Chris Nolan...
And Chris, you've been sitting with me in theaters sobbing yourself, Chris. So don't give me that girl stuff.
No, we saw Life is Beautiful
together, and we were wiping each other's tears.
We didn't wipe each other's tears. We were definitely both crying. No, listen, I respond to movies for that reason also. I just find it interesting that you can't respond to movies that are solely cerebral. A movie like 2001 that has zero emotion. I mean, on the emotion scale, it's literally a zero. There's nothing. It's only thought. And to put Inception in that category is not appropriate. This movie has, there's a lot of emotion. There's certainly a lot more. I think the stuff that sticks out, on the first pass is the guns and is the dreams and the technology and all that kind of stuff. I really do feel on repeated viewings, the stuff that sticks out is the emotional stuff and the scenes between him and his wife and between Cillian Murphy and his father in particular.
When you get to that final scene,
yeah,
that is very emotional, and also I think the end, the last shot of the last 2 minutes of the movie. I will say this: the crowd behind us cheering and clapping at the very end. This is just after one viewing.
Yeah.
Is that Chris Nolan being a smartass, though, that last shot?
I think so. People are arguing about that all the time. They're saying,
yes.
Oh, was it a dream? Was it not a dream? Besides that last shot, there's nothing else that I can find in one or two viewings that would lead you to believe, and spoiler alert for any fucking idiot that's listening to this conversation that has not seen the movie. There's nothing beyond that last shot that would lead you to believe that it's a dream. There's nothing.
Right.
The only thing that leads you to believe that is the last shot, or the way the last shot is ended, which is a smash cut to black.
Right.
So yeah, I think that's the way. I think that's Chris Nolan being a smartass, being a good filmmaker. In the first time I saw it, it got nothing. In fact, I heard one groan. I smiled. I thought it was Chris Nolan being a smartass. The second time I saw it, it got a big laugh. From almost the entire theater, an acknowledging laugh, a chuckle. But that was a Sunday afternoon crowd.
Right.
James,
yeah.
You and I have worked at the movies. You know that is a different crowd than your Saturday night or Friday night crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's exactly what it is. Do you?
Yes. Yeah. That's exactly what I think it is, and I don't necessarily have a problem with that. I don't think it's a cop out.
No,
not at all.
A cop out would be that the village is in the village and it's modern times. No, never mind.
But you know what? You know what? I'm losing my train of thought. I forgot what I was going to say. It was something really important. All great filmmakers are master manipulators. So I don't have a problem being played with, you know. One of our favorite filmmakers between the three of us is Brian De Palma, and who's better at that?
Master at that.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
I want to be kind of not humiliated. Those are my relationships.
That's Michael Haneke.
I want to be manipulated when I see a movie, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, there's nothing wrong. Spielberg does that. Spielberg, you know, basically winks at the camera, you know, like with his filmmaking in a lot of ways. And we love it. And I love that ending to Inception. I thought, I can't imagine a better ending to that movie. I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. I really couldn't agree more.
All right, so you gave Dark Knight an A-, Chris. What would you give this one?
Oh, I don't know. It's easier to... And by the way, I don't officially give The Dark Knight an A-. I'm just saying, if you guys gave it an A, I gave it an A-. I mean, I loved it as much as you did.
So I can't publish an A-minus for you anywhere with The Dark Knight?
No, don't.
Okay.
Take your hand off that chisel with that stone in the other hand. No, I don't know. It's hard for me to do a A to F scale. If I were doing a four-star scale like Ebert, I would give this movie 4 stars. That doesn't mean it's an A+. That doesn't mean it's the greatest movie of all time. But for what it tries to accomplish, I think it accomplishes it as well as anyone can.
Right.
And to that end, I say it's a 4-star movie. I think everyone should see it. I think it's the kind of movie that will age well. It's got good performances, got a good script, got a fantastic score, it's got a great cast, it's entertaining, it's challenging, it's got a good ending. You can talk about it for hours afterwards. It's flawed.
Yeah.
It's got a little fat in it. It's got some, like you said, the snowstorm or the snow scene, you know, with the ice castle or whatever the fuck you want to call it. That didn't work so well. It's got some other, you know, Joseph Gordon-Levitt's wrapping people up while they're floating around. How many times can we cut back to Joseph Gordon-Levitt wrapping people up with a fucking phone cord or whatever the hell he's wrapping them up with and putting them in there?
But
and setting charges and blasting them.
Low
it
gravity.
Seems a little much.
That low gravity fight, though, that whole hallway sequence, I did think was incredible, though.
It was great. It has incredible action sequences.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, it's got a little bit of fat on it.
Yeah.
But all told, I don't think you can ask for a better experience, certainly not in this climate, this year, and this summer in particular.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the flaws don't detract from the enjoyment.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
All right. Good convo.
Yeah, it was.
You know what's getting great buzz, guys? And you're probably going to groan when I say this, but Salt.
Yeah.
But it is Philip Noyce, so, I mean, The Quiet American and the two Jack Ryan movies, so...
That's what they're saying. They're saying, this is a guy that knows how to make these kind of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they already got the
sequel penned, Paprika.
Wait a second. Are you serious? There's a sequel?
No, he just made a joke, dude.
I know. But I wouldn't. I love this thing. Before the movie even comes out, there aren't like sequels. So I'm like, come on, guys.
They want it to be a franchise, but if this takes, it won't be. But yeah, they'll go through all the spices, I'm sure. If this is a success.
I don't know. I mean, it looks like it'll be a moderately successful movie. I think people are into this kind of shit right now. We've had a lot of childish shit so far this summer. And by the way, when you started off the show saying we're here to talk about the movie that everyone wants to talk about, I thought this conversation was about The Sorcerer's Apprentice. What the fuck?
Did you know there's a recession on with Jerry Bruckheimer's having trouble getting people to go to the theater?
I don't know.
We've had lots of fucking Prince of Persia and sorcerers and all kinds of bullshit and werewolves and vampires and all kinds of dumb shit this year. So I think people are in the mood for, Angelina Jolie running around in her bra and panties, firing an Uzi at a couple of fucking Russians or something,
I think so. It's a very efficient 95-minute movie, and they say it's just action, really ingeniously staged and shot action. They say it's an exemplary addition to that genre of film.
Isn't it weird that this was supposed to be a Tom Cruise movie, and yet we saw Tom Cruise in a movie it's very similar to this that came out a month ago.
Yeah.
So all fucking logic would tell you that he turned down Salt to go make Night and Day. Bad move, or would this have had the same results if Tom Cruise had made Salt? Would Salt then have been the same result as Night and Day? Well, I guess what I'm asking is did Night and Day tank because Night and Day sucked, or did Night and Day tank because we're done with Tom Cruise? I'm not ready to believe that we're done with Tom Cruise yet. I don't know.
It's hard to say, dude. It's.
I would be hard pressed to try to come up with a type of project that Tom Cruise can resuscitate himself with, and I think that was the basis of his decision to do Night and Day, the movie star, the one with the big smile, the one that's funny and charismatic and athletic.
Mm-hmm.
That's what he was going for with Night and Day, I'm sure.
I think he's got a. I agree with you. I think that people are done with him. I don't think that Night and Day was just the wrong project or something like that. I think. Well, I should rephrase that. I do think it was the wrong project. I think he needs to start doing other stuff. He's got to start making a living doing stuff like Tropic Thunder and things like that. I think his career actually is going to be similar to William Hurt's career in a way, because William Hurt was a leading man.
He's going to turn character actor. Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to turn into a character actor, and I think he's going to be a damn good one. But he's got to make that decision and quick.
Some of the best performances he's given. I mean, you look at Magnolia, have been in that vein. I think that is where he needs to move. He's about to make a colossal mistake because he's mulling over the idea of doing a reality show about he and his wife and child.
Wow.
So he could show people how normal he is.
That's the last thing you'd really want to do if you were him. I mean, that's just like cheapening yourself. I mean.
Oh, and also, if he's trying to show how normal he is, it's going to be like when Michael Jackson turned the cameras on himself. He's like, look how normal I am. And it was a fucking freak show.
He's not normal. He's a multimillionaire who is known the world over. He can't go anywhere in this earth.
Just like me,
without
Jane, just like us.
Exactly, and certainly we're not normal. Just throw that out the window. Yes, he marries somebody just like all of the rest of us. Yes, he makes babies the same way we do, but that doesn't make him normal. I don't know if he does make babies like we do.
Your jizz into a test tube and inserting it into Katie Holmes by force?
He makes babies the same way we do, with a turkey baster. So that is a colossal mistake. But
I know
networks would jump all over it.
But it's just like when you – I think this is the problem too, not just with him, but I think with all the – when we get to know so much about our actors they're all over the place. You're spreading yourself thin, but we know too much about you, and it's cheapening yourself. And this would be the worst thing he could do, I think.
Yeah.
Good point.
Really,
I don't know. I don't know a single person who's gone the reality TV route who ultimately has been better for their career, legitimately.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I just don't – I mean, would you – I mean, Jamie, what would you do if Al Pacino decided to do a reality show?
Oh, well, he's doing you one better. He's doing commercials these days.
That's true, the coffee commercials.
He did one commercial overseas, which has been done by countless big stars.
Harrison Ford, Woody Allen. I'm giving him shit about the coffee commercial. I'm far more disappointed in him for the Night with Al Pacino tour that he's doing.
Now, why are you? Why is that? Why do you think that cheapens him?
Oh, it's pathetic, is it not? I'm going to pack this auditorium full of 700 people. We're all going to talk about me and how awesome I am and how well I played a Cuban drug lord.
Let me say
like,
this.
Come on. We're going to take questions from the audience, and how many of those questions are going to be realistic, serious journalist-type questions? How many of them are going to be, drooling softball questions, like about how great was it to play a blind man and all this kind of shit? Like,
do you equate it the same way, like an Oliver Stone or Spike Lee speaking at colleges? For the public?
Speaking at colleges is a university recognizing that someone artistically has someone to give and paying them a fee to come and speak to young people. This is Al Pacino asking everyone to pay the ticket price to come in and see me, like he's a fucking elephant at Barnum and Bailey Circus or something like that,
Oh, that's some elephant.
I think it's something different. I actually think it's brave, and I understand the thinking behind it.
Oh, my God.
I'd chime in on this.
Even if De Niro did it, I would feel the same way. This is sharing.
Shit. This is what you're going to say, right? Shit.
The process with an audience, and if he gets up and he performs Shakespeare, which he undoubtedly will, and he talks about the process of what he responds to in material and the worth and value of it. It is no different than making a movie and sharing that with someone.
Oh my God, you sir are deluded.
It's no different from him going to colleges and speaking about Shakespeare and that kind of thing. I guarantee the main motivation.
Oh no.
Okay. You brought up De Niro too when you said this. So, 20 years ago, I would never have thought either one of these guys would be in the position they're in now. I never thought they'd take every project that comes their way. I never thought they'd be in movies that we would think are less than crap, but they are. These are the two greatest actors of their generation. And there was the great thing about Pacino was he disappeared for a while. That was one of the smartest things. That's one of the smartest things any actor can do. I guess you can't do that in this day and age anymore because you got to pay bills. Everyone's got to pay bills, but there used to be a thing. You would never associate Pacino or De Niro with being in something really subpar. But sadly, that's the case. More so, I think, with De Niro than Pacino. But still, they're both...
You're right.
88 Minutes, I'm thinking about, and Righteous Kill come to mind. And Two for the Money still is a low, 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 low point. But
there's a few more in there.
Simone.
I think his decision to do this evening with Al Pacino is no different from him wanting to do free Shakespeare in the Park.
Oh, so why did he not do it?
Shakespeare in the Park is something I would have always associated with him. I just think I'm saying, and this is inevitable, I guess, with the rise of the internet and with the 24-hour news cycle and all that stuff. But these guys, the best thing about all these actors, all if you want to call them Brando's sons or whatever, and Brando was good at this for a long time before Christian Brando ruined everything for him. They kept out of the spotlight. They kept that. There was a mystique to them. And that's a problem today in the last 15 years. There ain't no mystique anymore about anyone.
Yeah. I think he's approaching his 70s, and after a while, you don't really give a shit about mystique anymore.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there's a mystique about this.
Mystique. I like that. A mistake.
I'm going to be laughing about this for a long time. All right, guys. Thank you, Chris. I know you got to get to bed.
Yeah, I got to get up to work in the morning, but it's been fun. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, no, it has been. It was really good. Really good.
Yeah, I've had a good time, too. Thank you, buddy.
All right, guys. See you.
All right, have a good night.
Bye, man. All right, Jerry, what else is going on? You know what? Comic-Con starts.
Yeah.
And I haven't read the – I don't really know what's going on at Comic-Con.
This is all I care about, Comic-Con. If you want to know the God's honest truth, I'm only really concerned with one movie now that Inception's out of the way, sort of. Scott Pilgrim. That's
right.
The only – that and The Expendables. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure that out with me. But those are the two movies I'm looking forward to. But I got to be honest, I haven't paid much attention to Comic-Con this year. I really haven't. I'm sure it will be a lot of fun.
Neither.
I know they're showing pictures from Thor and everything. But if we've learned any lesson in the last year, let's stay off Twitter. Let's stay off everything. And maybe we'll enjoy the movies when they come out instead of being like, well, Kick-Ass was really good, but I wasn't blown away by it kind of vibe. And I'm going to buy Kick-Ass on Blu-ray and watch it again. But, I mean, you know, I think in the era of these, in the social networking, and we're all kind of guilty of this, we all want to know about these movies that we're looking forward to or books or whatever or CDs. You know, we get to know too much about it long before the finished product comes out. And I'm really this time with Comic-Con, with Fantastic Fest, a lot of stuff, just going to stay away because I just want to kind of be surprised because I'm just sort of noticing there's a level of burnout before the actual thing comes out.
Well, the big showcase, I guess, all eyes will be on Tron Legacy this year, like it was with Avatar last year.
I think that's the big one this year. Because was it at Comic-Con last year, I know, that they had the sneak preview for Inglourious Basterds?
I don't think Inglourious Basterds was represented at Comic-Con.
Okay.
I can't remember if it was or not.
Not that that
so.
Was ruined for me. I didn't think it, you know, I say this, Inglourious Basterds had a subpar trailer, and the film itself obviously, well, wowed me with more than I care to admit. But, no, I think Scott Pilgrim for me is, and you're right, Tron Legacy is obviously the top dog, I think, this year. That's the big one.
Yeah.
But for me, Scott Pilgrim is the other thing.
You know what, and we might have Edgar Wright on the show, I don't know yet, but... did he direct that?
Yes, he did. Now let me ask you this because my memory sucks when it comes to this. Wasn't Edgar Wright one of the directors I put down as the ones to look for of the decade and then to look?
No.
Oh, he wasn't. Okay. Well, I fucked that one up.
But we're talking about the Al Pacino thing cheapening him and speaking in public. So Judge Roy Bean said that they should avoid doing interviews. If an actor's smart, they don't do the interviews. I couldn't disagree more because. If they didn't do interviews, we wouldn't have any guests. And I just want to let people know, next Wednesday night show we'll have actor Robert Duvall on.
And he'll have a lot to say. He'll probably have something to say about Pacino.
Yeah. Mr. Godfather, Apocalypse Now, Tender Mercies, on and on and on and on and on. And in a little bit, we're going to get to our interview with the director of a great new documentary on the life and contributions of Hugh Hefner, and it's eye opening. It's a good conversation, and it's really a great film. But next week will be Robert Duvall, and then in September we're already getting guests together for a 6-part tribute. It'll play the whole week, the first week of September, to 6 thrillers from director Brian De Palma. The thrillers being Sisters, Carrie, I'm counting on my fingers to make sure I don't miss anything, The Fury, Dressed to Kill, Blowout, and Raising Kain.
Wow.
And, of course, other De Palma films will factor in there.
Right.
Too. I'm paying attention to the chat room.
I am paying attention to the chat room, too. I'm disturbed, to say the least.
Yeah. Just let me know if I need to excavate anyone from the chat room.
I think you might have to excavate.
Jesus Christ. Wow. Jesus Christ wants to listen to something about you, Hefner.
I know, really. Wow. I just don't know what to say.
Anyway, so that's what's upcoming on the big podcast. So if you have any questions for Robert Duvall, we might ask them during our interview next week. Just look us up on Facebook and post it on our profile, and we'll see if we have time to ask them.
And no, don't ask the question, why didn't you do Godfather 3? Please don't ask the question. You might hang up on us.
Jesus Christ left the building. Just want to let people know.
Okay.
He was being inappropriate in the chat room. That Jesus, you know. That'll be, if I ever make a sitcom, that's what the title is going to be. That Darn Jesus. That'll be the name of it. Anyway, what else is happening? Is there any movie news?
I think we talked about the big thing. Inception is really the big story of the week, cinematically, and obviously whatever's going on is going to happen at Comic-Con this weekend. Now, we're having a show Sunday, aren't we?
Yes. Sunday are the filmmakers of the new Kevin Kline movie, The Extra Man.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And I did see Get Low, the Robert Duvall movie, the one that he's coming on
good,
to promote.
Is it a good movie? Is it as good as it looks? I mean,
it's great.
Okay,
it's great.
Cool.
And there, it's Robert Duvall and Bill Murray and Sissy Spacek, and it's a true story about this old hermit back in 1920s or 30s in the South.
Mm-hmm.
He was a hermit for like 40 years. And he was kind of whispered about, and everybody had a negative thing to say about him because he was irascible and not very friendly. He felt death coming on, and he wanted to hold a funeral party. He essentially wanted to attend his own funeral where everyone could come up and say something about him, like a memory, as unpleasant as that memory might be. And Duvall's great. And as usual, you never see any effort in his acting.
Right.
And he has this monologue at the end that is so emotional, and it plays like a moment of transcendence. I mean,
okay, cool, good.
It's just a static camera on him the whole time, mm-hmm. and you're with him, man. I mean, what a gorgeous actor.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his work is just beautiful. When you reach, and it's always been good, but when you, it seems like he's at a great place, you know, where it just, it flows, you know, and it is effortless. And hearing how he approaches his work, I think he's gotten to a point where it is effortless, where he doesn't
right.
torment. He's not one of those guys that torments himself to get to a moment.
No, that's true. That's very true.
He's got this endless reservoir of stuff. Mm-hmm. And Bill Murray is awful funny in it. Bill Murray, who's...
Did
who I've been reading.
GQ interview with him?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's eccentric, isn't he? I mean,
no, he's great, though. He's always been like that, though, which is so funny. But I never watched Seinfeld. I watched the last episode. I thought it was terrible.
Yeah.
That was classic. I was just like, oh, my God.
I'm looking through other movie news. And I saw a couple of movies, actually. I saw The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm. And you liked it. You liked
it. Really liked it.
It was good. It was a really good movie, yeah.
It's probably my top movie of the year so far, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I realized that it came out overseas a year ago, like in 2009.
Right.
But
mm-hmm.
it came out here this year. But
yeah.
It's a great flick. What isn't so great is Chloe. Did you see Chloe?
Yeah. Chloe was, oh, God. It was kind of embarrassing. You know, I love Adam Egan, but Jesus Christ, what was he thinking with this? And, you know, Liam Neeson, Julianne Moore, and Amanda Seyfried, all these great actors, and it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
I just didn't care. How's that? I really just didn't give
it. I didn't either, and it was curious because on the surface it seems like this is perfect material for a Goyan.
Mm-hmm.
And it kept me interested for a little while because there was a very attractive woman that was nude throughout most of it. But it kind of divulged into ridiculousness as it went on.
It did. It did. It really did.
Yeah, it went from a movie about sexual obsession and awakening to a really stupid kind of whispers in the dark kind of thriller, you know, something on that level.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, it just was. It was. I. You know, you're right. You know, it is something that on the surface, right? Adam could have had a lot of fun with, but he played it straight on, like, you know, for once.
Yeah.
And yeah.
Here. Let's bring on Dean for a little bit before we play this interview. just for about 15 minutes. The interview is about 20 minutes in length. Hey, Dean.
Hey, what's going on?
What's up? Let me finish my thought, and then you can join
All
in.
All right, go ahead.
I also rewatched a couple of movies. I rewatched Right at Your Door,
mm-hmm.
which is a great, effective little movie.
Yeah, it is.
It's a great movie that works being under the radar because it does feel like a discovery. Remember that it's about a dirty bomb that goes off in the center of L.A. and the aftermath of that, but it's told very intimately. Remember that guy that mentioned Right at Your Door when he called in? He was Arab or Middle Eastern.
I vaguely remember this. Yeah.
He talked about, I know people that have plans to set up dirty bombs in L.A. and it's going to be catastrophic. And you and I were talking about, should we call the FBI?
I do remember this. Yes.
The freaks that call into our show. And speaking of which, Dean, what's going on tonight?
Well, I wanted to mention, now that you're mentioning Right at Your Door, I wanted to mention a movie called Special Access, which is a movie from the early 80s.
That's an adult film, isn't it?
very funny. No, it's a great movie which actually portrays the possibility of a dirty bomb before anybody knew what a dirty bomb was, and it's got it portrays it in such a way where you're looking at a television. You know, replay right before you, you know, like complete with commercials and stuff. Mm. And it is really great. Special Access is a really, really great movie from the early 80s. It's not, I mean, it's got a lot of character actors in it and everything. It's really terrific. It's got David Morse in it as as one of the terrorists, quote unquote. And it's really terrific. It's pretty much unlike anything I've ever seen because as a movie, there's not many movies out there that try and reproduce television, television as you're watching it, you know?
Right.
I mean, the only one that I can think of is maybe Kentucky Fried Movie, and that's it. Amazon Women on the Moon or something like that.
Right.
But,
okay, I got you.
From a visual standpoint, Network tried to replicate the look of
Well, it did, but it went behind the scenes, you know what I'm saying? Like,
I'm not talking about content. Yeah.
But this is a movie that, like, from beginning to end, it's all about, like, you watching television.
Uh-huh.
And it's really, really terrific. And like I said, it's a movie about somebody trying to launch a dirty bomb before we even knew what a dirty bomb was. So Special Access is a really great movie.
Special Access to your dirty bomb.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, Netflix, I was talking to Chris earlier, they have Adam Resurrected. Did you check out Adam Resurrected yet, Jerry?
No, I haven't. I have it on that Netflix thing, but I have not checked it out yet.
I keep forgetting that that's even available. The Paul Schrader movie with Jeff Goldblum that disappeared completely.
Oh.
Dean, did I lose
Dean?
You? We lost Dean. All we heard was,
Dean, I'm so excited.
It's like you fell off a cliff or something.
I know, really.
I'm calling you from a cliff. like
no,
Grand Canyon or
that's
something.
The only one I haven't seen by him, you know, so I'm very curious to check that out.
Yeah, and for anyone that doesn't know, we interviewed Jeff Goldblum and Paul Schrader both about Adam Resurrected. Apparently Dean doesn't know that either, so I say that for his benefit as well. all right, well, barring Dean calling back in, which it doesn't look like he's doing. Maybe he's still talking, and he doesn't realize he's disconnected.
Yeah, he might not know.
let's go ahead and play this interview. There's Dean again. Hang on. Let me see. Dean, you disconnected.
I know you're about to, like, play the interview and everything, but, hey, listen, that Jeff Goldblum performance in that in that Paul Schrader movie is superb. I'm telling you, it is really something. It's really something to behold, and it's one of the most underrated movies of the past couple of years. So
good.
No, that's good to hear. No, because I definitely want to check it out.
Well, Dean, did you hear? Did you hear our Jeff Goldblum or Paul Schrader interviews that we did for it?
No.
Damn it, Dean.
Well,
I thought you were a fan of our show.
Well, that's before I became a fan.
So wait,
that's,
what's the name of the movie?
Pre-fan.
Let me ask you a question, though. I'm just going through David Morris's resume. What was the name of that movie? Special Access, you said.
Special Access. I think I might have it wrong, actually. I hope I don't have it wrong, but I might. Yeah, David Morris is terrific. I mean, you think about David Morris's career, you think about, he's been in...
And Elsewhere, and that's what the first thing I remember him in, that, and I do remember, there's a movie listed here from 1983, a TV movie, I remember, Prototype, that he was in, that was good, and we also...
It's right around there. It might be Public Access. It might be... I might be completely wrong on the title there, but
Was this a made? This was a made for TV movie, right?
Well, kind of.
Let me ask you a question. Does it take place from the point of view of the TV news, like you're watching?
Yes, yes,
I remember this. It was on NBC, I think, actually.
Yes. But it was also released theatrically.
Okay. No, that's cool. I know, but I'm just looking. I don't see it listed because I think it was from 83 or 84.
It is. It's right around there. It's really great. And is it called Public Access?
I'm not seeing a listing for it, Dean. That's what's bugging me.
I don't know, dude. Let's figure this out while we're on the show.
Wait, it's definitely David Morris. I mean, come on. This is film geek stuff here. Hey, but... David Morris is really, really great. Film geek kind of stuff. David Morris is really great. Just think about David Morris being in something like The Hurt Locker,
mm-hmm.
and then also being in Dancer in the Dark, which was a huge role for him.
Yeah, that was.
And then also, like, really early on in the 80s, pre-Saint Elsewhere, he was in a great movie by Richard Donner called...
Inside Moves. That's his
Inside
first movie.
Inside Moves.
That's a good movie. I like that movie.
Inside Moves is one of the great unsung movies that, seriously, everybody will love. I mean, like, those people in middle America will love this movie because...
Even those people. You know,
you should listen. You're going to get us killed. You're going to get us
killed. That's a movie that Stephen Hawking and Sarah Palin would love equally.
I will stand up right towards that. What is that David Morris movie? Come on, man.
It's not listed here. I'm not seeing it. I see Our Family Business, Inside Moves, Our Family Business, Max Dugan Returns, Prototype, Shattered Vows, When Dreams Come True, Personal Foul, Six Against the Rock, Down Payment on Murder, A Place at the Table, St. Elsewhere, obviously, Winnie, Brotherhood of the Rose, Midnight Caller, which I remember that show.
In this movie. I mean, I'm for sure.
Think of him, I always think of The Crossing Guard. That's always the first movie.
Yeah, me too, yeah.
Yeah, that was great, too. That's true. That was
dude, I don't think he was in this movie. I know what movie.
Yes, he was. He was.
Does he have an alias he has under?
All right.
Like David Moskowitz or something?
Yeah, Robert Redford
is
his alias.
I will tell you, I'm going to listen to this interview because I'm very interested in the interview. And at the end of the interview, I'm going to stick my damn head out the window and call you with the name of this movie.
And say, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
I will. I'll say it with sweat dripping off of my forehead.
All right, Dean, while we have you on the phone, we might as well do this.
Movie trivia.
Let's do a round of this. This is always fun. You ready?
Yes.
If anyone else wants to play out there, you got 5 minutes to call in if you want to play movie trivia.
We got the judge calling.
The judge or anybody listening right now.
Me and Jerry against trivia. That'll be good.
Okay. I'm going to give you level two questions.
No, three.
No.
Give him three.
Give me three. Come on.
All right.
Just to show everybody that I know.
I wish Jesus Christ would call in.
Yeah, man. He'd be like,
okay. There you go. Within 10 minutes, Dean, how long does Porky's last?
Oh, 92 minutes.
All right, hang on. You're right. It lasts 94 minutes.
That's pretty good, man.
That's about 90 minutes too long for Porky's. All right, Jerry.
Uh-oh.
The Long Good Friday and Zulu Dawn both starred which actor?
Bob Hoskins.
You're right.
Wow. I love The Long Good Friday. Since we're talking about The Long Good Friday, can I say something about
yes.
The Long Good Friday? It's a great movie, but I actually think the Bob Hoskins character is just, that's like his best role. That's just his all-time
I
role.
I have something to say about that, too. You know, they're remaking Mona Lisa.
What?
They're remaking Mona Lisa with Mickey Rourke in the lead.
Who's going to play the other part?
I don't know.
His chihuahua.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when that movie The Long Good Friday came out, my pickup line always to women was, "Hi, my name's Friday." Okay. Dean, which Julie starred in Before Sunrise?
Oh, Julie Delpy, of course.
There you go.
And she wrote a couple of songs for the sequel, Before Sunset, that are absolutely amazing.
Yeah, they are. They are very good.
Yeah.
I'm just asking you to answer the question, Dean. I don't need any information beyond that.
Okay.
All right, Jerry. which John was featured in Presumed Innocent?
Which John?
Yeah, his first name's John. What's his last name?
Oh,
actor
God.
In Presumed Innocent.
Okay, let me. I have. All right.
Ooh,
this is a tough one. Wow.
Yeah, it's very tough.
I'm gonna say, and I'm wrong, but I'm gonna say John Hurd. But
hang on.
No! All right.
Thanks, Mel.
Was that Mel Gibson?
Yeah, that was Mel Gibson.
Yeah.
Wow.
The actor is John Spencer.
Ah, okay, yeah, I wasn't going to get that, okay.
He plays Harrison Ford's partner and, you know, the West Wing guy.
I didn't even think that, wow.
He's a very good actor.
No, he is.
Dean, who links the soundtracks of Psycho and Taxi Driver?
Well, that's easy, that's Bernard Herrmann.
Very good.
Bernard
Very
Herrmann,
good.
Actually, Bernard Herrmann actually...
I told you just answer the question.
But wait, I want to, like, throw one extra thing in.
All right.
Bernard Herrmann actually finished the soundtrack to Taxi Driver.
And died
about, not more than a few hours later. But.
Yeah. Yeah, we got a lot out of that, Dean. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Jerry. I just feel like being a smart aleck tonight.
You know,
I don't know why.
Go ahead.
God, some of these are hard. Okay. Which Ron was featured in the film Reversal of Fortune?
Oh, Ron Silver.
Very good.
Oh, yeah.
You got a story about that, Dean?
No. Except that he was a hardcore Republican, but other than
that. But that was 9/11 did that to him, I think. Wasn't that, which happened to a couple of those guys, 9/11.
That was the true tragedy of 9/11.
Right.
All right.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay,
Dean. Is this a Dean? Yeah, this is a Dean question. Yeah. Which actress links Blade Runner and Legal Eagles?
Oh.
Daryl Hannah, right?
Very good.
Thank you.
It's hard to believe that these are level 3 questions here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we need to get into level 10 or something.
Now, this is as hard as this book gets. Nobody else is calling in. Nobody else wants to take us up on our trivia challenge.
They're scared.
Where's the judge, man? Where's the judge?
Yeah, where's the judge?
Yeah. Yeah, no one's missing anything, so I'm waiting for the judge to call in to break that.
No, I missed one.
Cycle.
I missed the one of the presumed innocent one I missed. So.
All right, Jerry,
yeah,
here's a great question
tough.
For you.
Oh, great.
The action of The Godfather starts in which decade? The first
the action,
film.
The first film would start in the 40s.
All right, wait for it. Yes, you're right.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I'm really surprised by that. I would have said the 50s, but...
All right, Dean.
The silence by the end of that scene.
I've learned to let the silence go by, so...
Okay, that's good. No, that's good. The story of my life, so yeah.
Okay, Dean, your category is headline makers.
I didn't know there are categories now. Okay.
30 seconds on the clock.
That's wild.
Okay. What was Marlon Brando's last movie of the 20th century?
Ooh.
Oh, I know this one, I think.
Wait, that wasn't The Score, was it? Was it The Score?
No.
No, it wasn't The Score, no.
Okay, well, that would be my guess. Okay.
No!
All right, the other one.
No! No!
Right.
What? Don Juan DeMarco? Is that it?
Mm-mm.
No. You tried twice, Dean. You still got it wrong.
I think I know it. I think I might know it.
What is it?
All right.
Free Money.
No.
Oh, well, I'm lost then.
Not according to this book. According to this book, it's The Island of Dr. Moreau.
But that's not, I thought it was Free Money was the... All right, but okay, well, Free Money... what year is... Well, I'll look at see what Free Money is. I thought that was his last one.
The very last thing that Marlon
Free
Brando
money.
Ever did.
I haven't even seen that.
I know that money. Isn't Charlie Sheen in that?
Yes, it is. It has that great scene where he gets out of that big truck and the shocks go up. I mean, it's an incredible...
Ironically, you know the very last thing that Marlon Brando did was something called Free Big Macs. I don't know if you guys are aware.
Okay, the reason I say
Free Money is
98. That's why I...
Okay.
I was here in New York City when he was doing The Freshman, and I got to see Marlon Brando coming out of his trailer, and just like in that movie you just mentioned, the shots went way up. So, but that was the main thing I remembered was just seeing the trailer like tip over and then like him coming out and it went wah, you know, like that. So that was the main thing I remembered.
All right, who am I on?
Me? You're
Jerry?
Me.
Okay.
Me.
Okay. Do you want to let him go? He's
It's me.
All right. Okay.
Don't sound disappointed.
Dean, your category is the 1970s.
Okay.
And here's your question.
All right.
Who was Juggs in Mother Juggs and Speed?
Oh, well, that's obvious. That was...
That's obvious.
That was... Raquel Welch.
Yes, you're right.
Good guess.
And you're right. Those Juggs are obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And a little trivia question. That was the movie that I was... Here's another very hilarious point about that movie, which not so hilarious, but it's funny that there's a point about it, which is that was the movie that I was watching when my mother called me and told me that that 9/11 was happening.
Thanks for bringing us all down.
Yeah.
I was like watching Mother Juggs and Speed, and I was like, hey, Mother Juggs and Speed, it's all right. And it's like 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock in the morning, whatever, when I was staying up all night. And she called me and said, you should turn on the TV and see what's happening. And I was like,
you know what? You know what? That is interesting. Because I equate all the important events in my life with movies sometimes. You know what movie I was watching? This is extremely personal, but I'm willing to share it with everyone. When I lost my virginity, what movie was on the TV?
What movie?
This is actually a question in this book,
that's
ironically.
Great.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre Part 2.
Wow.
That.
So,
you know where I was when I lost my virginity?
Was it the original King Kong?
No. Let me tell you, because you'll love this.
I doubt it.
No, you will, because I was at the premiere in New York City with my girlfriend, who I loved, at the premiere of Top Gun.
Wow,
dude. That's just a movie about that? No, all right. Can we go to the next question? Because I wanted to say something really
You can't
hard.
Top that, can you?
I can't top that. I can't top Top Gun. There's no way I could top. Well, on many levels, I can't top that, so.
Yeah.
Okay,
I
Jerry.
Wait. I had a poster. Wait.
TMI.
You'll love this, so it's funny. I had a poster for, because he hadn't done too many movies. I had a poster for All the Right Moves that I wanted Tom Cruise to sign the next day afterwards, and I had a really bad pen. So I went back over. The pen wouldn't work.
Your girlfriend said the same thing that night. I don't know if you're aware.
Yes.
That pen
worked. The pen wouldn't work, so he said, "Well, just come back up and I'll sign it or whatever." So I came
back over there
and I signed it. He was about to leave, and he said, "Well, why don't you come downstairs and have a drink with me or whatever while I wait for the limo?" So I had a drink with him, and he was really interested because I was from Atlanta and he had just spent a lot of time in Atlanta preparing for. Or hanging out with Paul Newman, and that's what prepared him for Days of Thunder.
Wow. You ever get the sense that Dean never talks to anyone until he calls in on Wednesday night, and then he just lets it all out?
Sometimes.
Aggressive
yeah,
energy,
true.
You know?
That's true.
Or
I mean,
he's at least had like
I mean,
five
not
red
about,
bowls. I mean,
not about movies, though, you know? I mean, no one wants to know about movies.
That's true.
All right, Jerry, your category is Woody Allen.
All right, that's cool. I can live with that.
Okay. Here's your question.
The way you said that, here's your question.
Go ahead.
Well, there are 25 questions here. I'm looking for a good one.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
What was his first straight drama called?
Oh, his first straight drama was Interiors.
I think you're right, and you are right.
Yeah, I mean...
You're all right. Very good. Very good.
Yeah, thank you.
Very
great
good.
Great movie.
Okay. Dean, your category is the 1980s.
All right.
I like how you get these categories. You know,
not so strong on the 1980s, but the 70s.
And it is. And it is a Daily Double.
All right.
This is a category on the 1980s, and they ask a question about Chinatown. What the heck is this book?
What?
Okay, hang on.
That's crazy. Go on to another
thing.
This
book has got some issues.
Yes.
Yeah. What was the name of the brain in the jar in The Man with Two Brains?
Oh, my God. That's a great question. Because, let me think about that for a second.
Oh, God. This is I can't even pronounce the name. I'm sorry.
All right. First of all, I know that the voice of the brain in the jar was Sissy Spacek.
Right.
Oh, man. I don't think I can answer this. That's out. I can't do
okay.
it.
Okay. It's Anne
Umalamarvar.
Umamahai or something.
Yeah, right. Well, that's very Steve Martin, so that makes sense. But I can't do that.
Okay, Jerry, your category is classics. Dun,
okay.
Dun, dun.
Dun, dun, dun.
Okay. What was the name of the owner of the six-foot-tall invisible rabbit, Harvey? Essentially, what was Jimmy Stewart's character name in Harvey?
I mean, I know it's on the tip of my tongue. I don't know it offhand.
I played this role on stage.
Oh, oh wow.
You played the Jimmy Stewart part, not the bunny.
No. I do other things like a bunny, but the on stage.
Okay. I didn't want to go there. Okay? I really didn't want to. You know, I honestly don't know. I don't know. I'm not even going to try to waste anyone's time here.
Thank you for not being like Dean and wasting our time. The character name is Elwood P. Dowd.
I should know that. I don't. Okay.
All right, Dean. Your category is
bunnies.
Bunny?
Your category is nuclear waste. No. Your category is Oscar Best Films.
All right.
But thank God Jason O'Brien's not on.
No, he would miss all of these. The friends in The Deer Hunter are from which state?
They're from Pennsylvania, right?
You're very right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
You couldn't be more right.
Thank you.
Jerry, your password is... No. Okay, I'll give you, Jerry, I'll give you horror. Horror.
Okay.
Horror.
Which is one of my least favorite words in the English language. It's a horrible word. Horror.
It makes you like work for it.
Yeah, you sound like a pirate every time you say it. That's what horror. You know. Okay, Jerry. What is the name? Well, that's who's the lead character. I won't ask you that one. That's iffy. What is John Cassavetes's occupation in Rosemary's Baby?
Ooh.
Wow, that's a really good question. That's a nice apartment too. let's think.
Yeah, they have a great apartment.
That's very true.
You're gonna kick yourself when I tell you.
I know you're gonna. I know I'm gonna.
I think I might know it, but let him go ahead.
I'm thinking. God, you know, these are things you don't really think about after a while when you think about these movies, like these important little details. But Blog Talk Radio host. No. No, I am going to say. Accountant, but I know I'm wrong, so.
I think he's an actor in it. Isn't he an actor in it?
Yes.
He's, okay.
Yeah, and remember, he essentially, by selling his soul, by selling Rosemary, in a way, his career starts to take off. Because the actor has an accident or something.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
right
in.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
Okay.
I remember him talking about commercials or something. That's all I remember.
Mr. Martin, your category is...
Martin? What are you talking about? Are you talking to me?
Yeah, Mr. Dean Martin. Your category is...
Okay, fair enough.
Anal bum covers.
Yeah, because you're obviously intoxicated, so I automatically think of Dean Martin.
Am I obviously intoxicated?
Oh, God, I hope so.
I've had three beers, all right? Three beers, for God's sake. All right, go ahead.
Your category is Orson Welles.
Okay,
all right.
Well, Orson Welles had more than three beers.
Let me ask you the question.
Go ahead.
How many Oscars did Citizen Kane win?
Only one. For
what?
Best screenplay, best original screenplay for both he and Herman Mankiewicz.
17. Well, this is wrong. I know that you're right, but the answer they give in this trivia book is 9. It wasn't even nominated for 9.
It was like nominated for maybe 9, but
Where did you get this book, man?
I don't know. This book was bought a long time ago.
I don't know how to trust this book now.
Well,
it put 9 in there? Come on. That was the year that Hal Green was My Valley won everything. But.
Yeah. Okay, Jerry. We'll go one more round.
Yeah, one more round.
And then we'll like go to the thing. Yes, definitely.
Yeah, the one
go
thing
the
everyone's
interview.
We're losing listeners.
No, they love it. Are you kidding me? Everybody loves game shows. Come on.
A lot of times we do save the interview for the end of the show, so it's
in
keeping
okay.
with that. Because we want to force people to actually sit through us.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they got to look at the ads and everything.
All right, Jerry, your category is action.
I think you're going to say the rapist, but okay.
Yeah. The penis mightier. Yeah. Okay. God, these are simple. Let me just tell you, this isn't your question, but this is their sample of a level 3, the hardest category question. What movie opens with the line, "What movie opens with the line, I believe in America?" That is not a level 3 question. That's a level 1.
Yeah,
that's
really.
Level
I mean,
one, for sure.
All right.
Go on to another one.
Okay. Jerry, who took next billing after Goldie Hawn in Sugarland Express?
Oh, that guy. It wasn't William Matheson, right?
No.
I would say Ben Johnson.
Oh, is
it was Ben Johnson, yeah.
Oh, I thought it was William Matheson. Okay, well, I fucked that one up. But he was in the movie, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Well,
he was the second lead.
He just wasn't
the second biggest name.
Yeah, no, you're right. Yeah. No, you're right. It would be Ben Johnson. Okay, well, I fucked that one up. Okay.
I
was in the right ballpark, though.
Yeah, yeah. You had your heart was in the right place for sure.
Thank you, Dean.
Your heart was in the right place.
View, but
All right, one more, and then we go. Right?
I'm looking for a good question for you, Dean.
Give me like a level 10, man.
There is no level 10, dude.
Dude, it's...
I'm just looking for the hardest one that everybody will go, what the fuck?
Well, all right. Okay, who wrote the screenplay for Casualties of War, Dean?
What? Oh, man. Was that Paul Schrader or somebody like that?
No.
I don't know. Brian De Palma. That's the only thing I can think of.
See, you can't handle a level 10 question if you can't get that.
Who did?
Jerry, do you know?
Off the top of my head, I don't know, actually.
I know without looking at it.
All right, tell us, please.
David Rabe.
Okay, no, that's a good episode. I knew it was a playwright.
All right,
but what was the movie that was a remake of?
Casualties of War?
Yes, indeed.
All right, what is it? All right, let me hear this. I've got to hear before we get the guy. Why do we have to bring up Casualty of War? Ben F. Armand White, what he said about it. But okay,
that was a remake of a movie that De Palma had in the Cannes Film Festival.
Okay.
Ready?
Okay.
It was called Dionysus 69.
That's a remake of that?
Yes, it's a remake of Dionysus 69.
How so?
Yeah, how? Now this. Because
it was about the exact same thing.
Well, Redacted is about the exact same thing too, but it's not a remake.
No. It was a movie. Dionysus 69 was about two Vietnam soldiers raping a Vietnamese woman during the wartime effort.
Are you trying to get on our De Palma thriller thing? Is that what this is all about?
Well, that's a very, very good segue.
Well, you know, it wasn't conceived as a remake, though. I mean, it might have the same incidents, but De Palma read a Vanity Fair piece or something about the story and enlisted David Rabe to write a screenplay based on it.
Yeah, well, that's him not telling you everything.
But he didn't tell me that. He told the rest of the journalists.
No, I'm telling you right now that Dionysus 69 was about that thing, and what does that tell you? It tells you that it was a hugely, hugely controversial movie back in the 69 Cannes Film Festival, and it was almost, it was like shunted back into the background. No one wanted to talk about it. No one wanted to say anything about it. And when Captains of War came around, he redid it. So
he redid it with Redacted, yeah.
Yeah, no, but yeah, it's interesting you bring that up, because we often on this show, at least we came to the conclusion that Raising Kane is the first time that he starts copying himself.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's
true what you're saying about this other. I know about this. I've never seen this movie, but if what you're saying is true, then it probably starts with Casualties of War. Then.
It has special profound meaning with the war films, though,
mm-hmm.
because we asked him about the comparison between Redacted and Casualties of War,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "Yeah, I agree. It's the same story. The point is, nothing has changed."
Right.
Right. Exactly. I mean, seriously, Dionysus 69 is a movie. It's never been released. I haven't seen it. I wouldn't say that I've seen it, but I've read about it. It's talked about in the book Hollywood on the Riviera, which is about the history of the Cannes Film Festival. And it is a remake. I mean, it's not officially a remake. It didn't say that. Oh, it didn't say anything like in the credits. Oh, based on a screenplay by blah 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 or whatever. But it's obviously a remake. So
okay.
Well,
we're gonna play the move the interview now, and then we're gonna close the show with a song that I wrote.
All right.
Really, a song that you wrote?
Yeah. A song that I wrote and sing. Yes.
You sing it? Really? You sing it?
Yes.
Yes, he sings.
You play everything, too, in it?
No, I had to hire professional musicians to play it.
Wow, good
so,
for you.
Well, man, something to look forward to in this show.
Yeah,
it's
really, man.
Time.
Come on, Dean. You got to get people
cool.
Something to look forward to, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool, very cool. I'm definitely looking forward to it. I'm going to rush back upstairs and do that.
What do you do? What do you have to do? Oh, God, you're drinking
I'm
Red
on
Bull,
the street,
aren't...
man. I'm on
oh,
the street.
Okay, okay,
they,
okay. I
they
you, like,
almost arrested me.
I think they almost.
They almost.
All right, all right.
Don't get
arrested. Dean, goodbye. Thanks for calling in, buddy.
Okay, let's do the interview.
Oh. Bridget Berman is the director of a great new documentary. It's terrific. It's called Hugh Hefner, Playboy, Activist, and Rebel. And it's very surprising. You might have seen profiles of Hugh Hefner in the past,
mm-hmm.
but none as eye-opening and insightful and downright inspiring as this one. And it opens in theaters in limited release starting this Friday, so look for it. But we talked to Bridget about her film and the portrait she paints of Hugh Hefner, and here is that conversation.
You can't love them all. You can't.
I wouldn't have started Playboy if I was afraid of controversy. I think that controversy is the way you change things. I want to live in a society in which people can voice unpopular opinions.
There are probably a lot of people today out there enjoying freedom who have no idea that Hugh Hefner was the pioneer who got all the arrows.
Chicago.
He was one of many human beings during that era that fought against injustice.
We repurchased the franchises and opened them up to all of our members, both black and white.
30 years from this year, Negro can become president.
Hess helped build that audience for a different attitude about civil rights.
Hugh Hefner was a very clever fellow, and I think also a very dangerous fellow.
The day that you are willing to come out here with a cottontail attached to your rear end.
Hugh Hefner is a pedographer, always was.
Well, it's pretty sensational. She's so well endowed.
Playmate of the Year, Dorothy Stratton. Dorothy, you want to come up here?
I create fantasies. Hef creates fantasies.
If you go to a museum and you see a Rubenesque painting of a beautiful naked woman, that's art. But if it's the same piece of art as in Playboy, it's pornography.
I'm confused. How can he be working for the devil and God at the same time?
I think it's possible that love is his rosebud.
He's giving wonderful hope to men over 100.
Tell me about how you first crossed paths with Mr. Hefner.
What a memorable moment. I received a call from his right-hand person, Mary O'Connor, and here I was in Canada, you know, in my apartment, and a call comes through. I'm calling from the Playboy Mansion, and I think, oh, my gosh, you know, Playboy Mansion, really, excuse me. And sure enough, and the reason she called is that Hefner, his favorite musician, is, of course, Big Spiderbeck, and I had made this long feature film about Big Spiderbeck, and he wanted to get a copy of it. And so I said to her, oh, please ask him to send me a letter, because I didn't quite believe it. It was so incongruous. And a few days later, a letter arrived, and I sent him a movie, of course.
Yeah. And you met with him? How did the subject of making a film about his life and contributions come up?
I met him probably a year after I sent him the film. What also happened was that the Big Spiderbeck film came out on the Playboy Jazz label, and it was featured at the Playboy Jazz Festival, Film Festival. And so I came down for that, and I met him for the first time, which was, you know, I mean, it was quite something, having the gates open, you know, in front of the Playboy Mansion was quite extraordinary. I, you know, this little kid from Hollywood, I mean, from Canada, comes to Hollywood, right?
Yeah.
you know, he was truly, the only thing that he was that I knew about him was that he wore pajamas. In every other way, he was extremely bright, a very smart man, you know, totally, and very charming, and knows movies inside out. Knows mm-hmm. music inside out. I mean, you know, many, many passions aside from women. And
right.
So that's when our friendship began, which lasted over quite a few years. And when he celebrated his 80th birthday party, I really wanted to attend that. I thought, you know, this is one event I would like to go to and be at. And so I was invited. And flew down with my partner and co-producer of the film, Victor Solnicki. And, you know, there we were at this incredible party. You know, glitz, glamour, painted women, just gorgeous, sumptuous. And it was beautiful. But I saw the Playboy. I saw him being celebrated and congratulated. You know, and it was as a Playboy, only that one side of him. And I had already gotten to know the other side of him, the activist, the rebel side. Every time I meet somebody and I get to know them better, I begin to research more about them. You know, and it's just something I do. I love researching. And on the way back from the party, flying back to Toronto, I turned to my partner, Victor, and I said, you know, that's what I want to do next. I want to make a film that shows the other side of Hugh Hefner. Mm-hmm. And the reason I really wanted to do it is I love making films about people who are complex, whose life is complex, and where there's a lot of conflict. Movies, you know, the best movies are filled with conflict. And that's what I decided to do. And so I began an even more intense research process to write a treatment. I FedExed it down and got a fax back from Mr. Hefner a day later, the very next day, giving me carte blanche.
He gave you carte blanche. Did he give you any specific instruction on what he wanted out of the experience?
Absolutely nothing. Nothing ever, nothing. No, nothing written down, nothing spoken. Nobody didn't suggest this or that. He knew my films. He knew I was a good filmmaker. He left it up to me.
Yeah.
And it's one thing I really respected about him.
What fascinates me about your film, because I've seen profiles of Mr. Hefner before,
yes,
but I had no idea what you speak to, the extent of his influence in shaping society in the latter part of the century, last century. Of course, it's a given that sexual taboos and boundaries, that he shattered those with Playboy, but I had no idea his importance in the civil rights movement or correcting social injustices or the influence of who he chose to put in his magazine or TV show. So when you you discovered this side of him and you wanted to express it, so that was the impetus for this film? That's what you wanted to express more than anything else about him through this film?
That is the side of him that I wanted to set the record straight. You know, I mean, many people know Hugh Hefner as the playboy, as the man who, you know, with many women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the Playboy Mansion and all those things, the Playboy Clubs. But very few people know about the other side. You know, the way you just put it, I couldn't have put it better. It's absolutely true. And when I started to do my real research, you know, when I was right upstairs at the Playboy Mansion in the third attic where the scrapbooks are kept and the over 2,000, and I just about went through all of them, the more I went through them, the more I discovered and uncovered, and the better and the more I realized all these incredible things, like the business about the two Playboy clubs in New Orleans and Miami, where they would not allow black members into their clubs. It was, they were franchises. And when Mr. Hefner found out about that, he was outraged. And he bought back the clubs, bought them back at a loss. You know, how many people would do that? And then turned around and opened them up to all members, black, white, didn't matter. And, you know, He believed very strongly in kind of standing up for civil rights and all those things. But above all, you know, these people were his friends. Black people were his friends. You know, all kinds of people were his friends. And there was not going to be any exclusion of people in the Playboy clubs, on his television shows. No way. This was against his own integrity, his own makeup as a human being, you know, and it didn't matter if on the shows where he showed, you know, black people mingling with white people in a party atmosphere, which is what Playboy's Penthouse was, and all these wonderful guests would come in, black and white and mixed racial groups like Lambert Hendricks and Ross, they were all there. Southern states would not buy these shows. It was a syndicated show. So he didn't make all the money on these shows that he could have. In fact, at one point he had to put his own money in to keep the shows going. He did. And he did never, ever, ever gave in to those people that would kind of ask him to therefore, you know, kind of not stick to his principles. He stuck to them, always. And that, no matter what you think about Hugh Hefner, no matter what you think about the girls and, you know, did he objectify women and all of that, you cannot take that away from this person. That he did make a huge difference. He changed America in many ways that we have felt, and I say we, Canada as well, the rest of the world. And by saying all this, I'm not being deferential. I have no intention of being deferential, nor is this film a Valentine to Hefner. No, it is something I wanted to set the record straight about a very complex man who people and the press has often just shown one side of, because that's the side they figure all the people want to know. It's the women, and it's the beautiful women, and it's the naked girls, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. To my mind, all these incredible things that he has done for civil rights, for human rights, you know, standing up, you know, for all kinds of issues, much more sexy than any of the other stuff, because that's the true, profound, hard stuff that sticks around, that changes society, changes people.
Well, there are so many preconceived notions about him.
Oh, right.
And I'm wondering, did you have any?
I had them when I was a young teenager and I was babysitting and I would see this magazine and I, you know, it wasn't about him, really. It was really about the magazine. I thought, you know, like, Well, I don't want to, you know, it's kind of, I'm not really interested in this magazine, and, you know, like, and I just put it aside. It didn't kind of outrage me in any way. I just, you know, well, okay, that's not for me. And the Playboy Mansion, when I, you know, like when I received that call, it was like so, so out of my sphere of who I was.
Surreal,
that,
yeah.
That, yeah.
Yeah,
you know, I couldn't quite believe it. And then, you know, it was real. And I try to not judge. You know, I always believe don't judge lest you be judged. I would hate to be judged by, you know,
mm-hmm.
You know, nobody should be judged. And so when I first met him, I was really more excited than anything because here I was going to meet this very incredible human human being, an icon already. And it was quite extraordinary that I was going to be invited to the Playboy Mansion. And, yeah, and, you know, when you come up here to this incredible place where, you know, in Los Angeles, and there are these lush grounds and animals and, you know, and what few people know is that he once, what he wanted to be many years ago as a young boy was a veterinarian. And so it's no surprise that he has a zoological license on the grounds, for the grounds, and whenever there's an animal, like an owl can be, was hurt, the wing, she couldn't fly anymore, it was brought to the Playboy Mansion. They called and said, you know, have you got room? Could we bring this hurt animal? And they would say yes. And there are amazing people here who look after these animals, care about these animals. You know, it is extraordinary, just extraordinary. So it's just what he says, a Shangri-La.
Yeah, but even so, you mentioned that the movie, you didn't set out to make a Valentine by any means. It is to the film's credit and your credit that you do include voices of dissension, mm-hmm. kind of people that do sit in judgment of Hef and what he does. That was, why was that important for you to include?
Because that also is part of the historical reality. When he brought up, when Playboy magazine first came out, there was an outcry. You know, it was the first magazine of its kind. He broke new ground. He was the first to jump into the frozen lake. It wasn't frozen. Mm-hmm. I'm just using an analogy. But he was the first, you know. And, of course, there would be an outcry. America, very puritanical in those days. In some ways, there was still some of that left behind. and people didn't like it. And so there were people who spoke up, people like Charles Keating, you know, who founded the Committee for Decent Literature. And he denounced Hef totally, and I have two clips in the film. Very, very important. Even Mike Wallace began by not liking him, considering him an upstart, actually counted how many naked girls there were in the magazine and calls it a, you know, a dirty book, you know, and that's how he found it. And, you know, Dennis Prager talks about him. Susan Brownmiller, the feminist, I tried to interview Gloria Steinem, tried three times, and she refused three times to be interviewed. I finally gave up. So, you know, Pat Boone,
right.
You know, Christian activist, very much so, who literally believes that Hefner has broken the moral code of America. And even though today Playboy is tame by comparison to what is out there on the net and in other magazines, the point is that he was the first. So he always, that is, but, you know, I mean, amazing, the when you think of it, you know, that the magazine that he began, this very controversial magazine that took America by storm, nobody expected a Hefner. He came out of nowhere, and suddenly there it was. And many years later, suddenly there's this empire. And he uses the money and his influence and power. Many people would just use it for their own gains. He doesn't do that. He has stuck his neck out and helped and supported many, many causes, taken on many parts of government that others wouldn't dare. And so he's on the enemies list of Nixon, Reagan, past enemies of Edgar Hoover, you know, and is under scrutiny. And many people, you know, really dislike him enormously.
Well, I'm curious because this had to be an important project for Hef as well. So when you show him the cut of the film, when you're ready to show him the cut of the film for the first time, how were you feeling? Were you nervous about that? And how did he react to it?
Well, you know, I was actually very excited. You know, it was, and I remember it very well. And I showed him when it was a half hour longer than it is now, because I wanted to make sure, not because for his approval, no. But I wanted to make sure that everything was correct, that the right pictures corresponded to what was being said, you know, and I knew that I had jumped chronology a few times and things and jumped it around. And I wanted to know if I made any mistakes, factual mistakes, by doing that. And that was important to me. And, you know, he, at the end, you know, he said, absolutely, you know, I understand what you're doing, he said. It's, you know, and he said to me, he said, you know, you really get me. And he was very deeply moved. And it was the greatest compliment one could get, you know, from a very perfectionistic person. I'm a perfectionist myself. You know, so I was driven all the way through into making this as real, as even-handed, as powerful a film as I could make it, and entertaining, you know, because it has to be entertaining. How can you make a boring film? Nobody would come to see it. So Gene Simmons is in there, you know, and he's very, very funny.
Okay, sorry, my computer froze up.
Okay.
That is
happening.
Yeah, Bridget Berman. She is the director of Hugh Hefner, Playboy activist and rebel. Check it out when it opens near you, starting this weekend. It's a great one. I can't recommend it enough.
Cool, sounds good.
It was number six on my half year list. That's the best film of the half year.
Oh wow! Okay.
All right. Well, I've enjoyed tonight, Jerry. Another fun show.
I mean, it's amazing that on these Wednesday night shows, it's this newfound trivia that's really and yours.
I know.
Yeah, the disgruntled game show host.
I never get asked anything.
No, but I mean, you're just like, you just remind me, you're doing a great Will Ferrell, Alex Trebek on Celebrity Jeopardy.
Yeah. And that's all I do on the show is ask people questions. I ask you guys questions. I ask guest questions. Our callers' questions. When am I going to be asked anything, Jerry?
Well, I mean, we could turn the tables. We could do what Charles Grodin did that one night on Carson and turn the tables on you. But
it'll be fine. Don't break my cigar box like
that. I would never do that. I would. God, Don Rickles will never live that down, that's for sure.
All right. Well, we'll close the show on a note that has, a literal note that has something to do with me.
That's good. See, it's all building up to that.
That's right. So this is a song I wrote and sang.
Okay, cool.
So I don't know how it'll sound. It's a blues song, the only blues song I've ever written or tried to sing. So it's a two-chord thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All right, Jerry, thank you, man.
Before I go, what, any influences that we should, you know, be aware of or anything?
Clearly not Barry Manilow.
Okay, all right. I know that you're working outside your comfort zone.
Yeah. Actually, I work it outside my comfort zone just by playing this.
Okay, no, that's cool. That's the only way you're going to know, man. That's cool. All right.
Letting anyone hear it. Okay. We'll be back Sunday night, Extra Man Filmmakers. And then next Wednesday, Robert Duvall and a great series of shows upcoming. A big, big guest I'm trying to work on that we should confirm by the end of the week.
Okay.
If we're gonna get her. But, Jerry, thank you, man. I'll see you Sunday night.
All right, Sunday night.
All right. Bye, everybody.
Down, beating down, down. down, beaten down, down. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down, down. She appeared like an angel from heaven. She went out like a demon untamed. Broke my mind with a constant harassing. Burned my soul with a cheating flame. She's as hot as a Georgia Sunday. She's as cold as an acid plane. Flattery is always her first place. But to see, it's the name of her game. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down, down. I was once cool-headed and happy. I had my manhood, I had my hell. Till she took all my sex and sanity. Now I can't recognize myself. Languished and lost in the land of lonely. I know pain, daddy, chapter and verse. And I won't make no more eyes at another girlie. Cause I know they all got that curse. Down, beating down, 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 down. Down, beating down, down. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down, down. You might think you're in love with this woman. Or maybe you're in it just for thrill. Either way, she'll make sure you start tumbling. Then she'll sneak up for the kill. Please don't take my words for granted. I'm the one who lived to tell. She's the kind that'll leave you stranded, wallowing now in the depths of hell. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Down, beaten down, down, down. Down, beaten down, 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 down. Now.